I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show. I am Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host. My first guest, Harry A. Millman, is a PhD consulting toxicologist and expert witness and president of ToxNetwork.com. He has assisted as an expert in over 250 civil and criminal cases involving drug overdoses, pharmacy errors, exposure to toxic chemicals and carcinogens, and assaults. He is often quoted in newspapers and magazine articles and has appeared as a toxicology expert on television news broadcast. Prior to becoming an expert witness, Dr. Millman was a scientist at the U.S. National Cancer Institute, National Institute of Health, and a senior toxicologist at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He has published 5 scientific books, including the widely acclaimed Handbook of Carcinogen Testing and over 70 research papers. A Death at Camp David is his first novel. He lives in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C. I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Dr. Millman, and I look forward to hearing about chemicals and cancer. Now, can you define chemical carcinogens?
Yes, thank you very much for having me on your show. I really appreciate that. And I would be happy to share my expertise and knowledge on chemical carcinogens with you and the audience of the show, because these are very important topics that everybody is concerned about. So when we talk about chemical carcinogens, we obviously have to define our terms. And the simplest way to look at it is that any chemical that can cause cancer is considered a carcinogen. So carcinogen means cancer-causing. Now, the problem is, how do you test for a chemical that causes cancer? So is a chemical that causes cancer in animals, for example, of equal concern to a chemical that has been shown to cause cancer in humans? Or, put another way, is do all chemicals that cause cancer in animals of concern for humans? And this is basically the issue that people are concerned about when they hear the word carcinogen. They don't know if that means that the chemical was found to be to cause cancer in humans or it was found to cause cancer in animals. Mm-hmm. And that sort of evaluation of the scientific information is done in the United States by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA. EPA evaluates all the scientific information that is published. They have peer review groups of notable scientists who review all the information that has been gathered of chemicals being tested in animals, what we know about their effect in humans, what we know about their effect on mutations and genetics. And they take all that information as well as what we know about the exposure of people to these chemicals, how much they are exposed and how often. And then they make some sort of an evaluation to identify whether or not we have enough information to say that this chemical causes cancer in humans, or put another way, is a known human carcinogen, or if there's not sufficient information to actually be that conclusive, they might put it in a separate category, for example, reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen. Mm-hmm. So the second category is one level lower than the maximum or most definitive level, which is known to be a human carcinogen. And the reason you get into that second level is because the information that is available just is simply not conclusive enough in humans to say definitively that the chemical is a human carcinogen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so now we have basically information that the chemical is known to be a carcinogen in animals. We know something about how it works. We know something about the exposure. But we just don't have enough information in humans to say that it is a human carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, now means that the public does not know how to use that information in their daily evaluation of exposure to chemical carcinogens. Are these chemicals that are reasonably anticipated to be human carcinogens of equal concern to those that are known to be human carcinogens? Or are they less a concern? Are they of any concern?
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we have a lot of discrepancy in information, and especially for a public that is not knowledgeable enough about carcinogens, and they don't know how to evaluate that information. So the Environmental Protection Agency basically evaluates chemicals in the general environment, whereas the Food and Drug Administration, for example, evaluates chemicals in foods and drugs, and chemical carcinogens in foods and drugs. And specifically, of concern are the ones that wind up in foods, because as we know, many crops are they use pesticides on them, and eventually can enter the food chain. Animals can be fed antibiotics and other pesticides. They wind up eating various products that contain pesticides, and then that eventually can get into the meat, and then people can get exposed through ingestion to chemicals inadvertently that were there in their food by virtue of coming from either antibiotics or pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
So the Food and Drug Administration came up in 1958 with what is commonly known as the Delaney Clause. The Delaney Clause is basically a statement that says, and it was based for food additives, that is to say chemicals at that time they were concerned about pesticides that entered the food chain, and they basically indicated that the Delaney Clause says that no chemical that causes cancer can be can be in foods. And this is substantially different than the way EPA looks at chemical carcinogens, because as a food additive, FDA says there can be absolutely no chemicals that cause cancer in foods.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas EPA says there is a certain level of acceptable risk. So we can have chemicals in the environment that cause cancer, but only up to an acceptable risk. And an acceptable risk, as far as EPA is concerned, is that the chemical causes one cancer, not more than one cancer in an individual in a million individuals. So you can only have one additional human who gets cancer from this specific chemical per million individuals in the United States. And considering we have about 300 million or so in our population, that means not more than 300 new cancer cases in the population from exposure to this one chemical. So here we are, EPA works under the assumption of an acceptable risk, whereas the FDA and its Delaney Clause and for food additives is no risk, absolutely zero risk. So this makes a substantial difference between chemicals that wind up in foods versus chemicals that wind up in the environment. Now, if we can just move on to, for example, one thing, if you heard me, we talked about acceptable risk. Again, what is risk? Risk is simply the likelihood, it's a statistical term, the likelihood that somebody who is exposed to this chemical will get cancer. And notice I say cancer, I don't say a specific type of cancer. So it's the likelihood that people who are exposed to a carcinogen, and let's, for example, just limit it to chemicals in the environment, will get cancer. So EPA, like I said, accepts an acceptable risk of one in a million. So how how do we evaluate whether what's the likelihood that a person will get cancer from exposure to a chemical that has been shown to cause cancer, and let's assume cancer in humans? And that process is known as a risk assessment process.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, assessing the risk or assessing the likelihood that a person who is exposed to a chemical carcinogen that causes cancer in humans will get cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that
mm-hmm.
assessment basically means you evaluate what we know about the chemical in terms of how it causes cancer. And that is based on everything that that is published in the scientific literature about how this chemical causes cancer, under what conditions, how much you have to be exposed to this cancer, what amount you have to be exposed for, how many years, how long. The how much is known as a dose response effect. So that's to say, depending on how much will depend how likely.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer, the more, basically, the more you are exposed, the longer you are exposed to a chemical at high amounts, the more likely it is that you will get the cancer from this chemical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Again, it doesn't mean that you will get it,
right?
But on a statistically, right. the statistical basis, looking at the large population, just as a general matter, the more you are exposed, the longer time period that you're exposed to a high amount of the chemical carcinogen, the more likely it is that you will get the cancer from this chemical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means that you can be exposed to lower amounts over an extended period of time or a high amount over a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So, generally speaking, the scientific literature studies people who are in the workplace who are constantly exposed to high amounts of this substance. For example, if we want to look at the cancer effects of formaldehyde, mm-hmm. we look at people, for example, embalmers who work with formaldehyde in a funeral home all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So they are exposed to high amounts of formaldehyde, and assuming they have long-term employment, then they're exposed for a lengthy period of time. And then we look to see what sort of cancer we see in embalmers from their exposure to formaldehyde.
Mm-hmm.
And we can tell, based on various records, how long they've been working as an embalmer, what the concentrations of formaldehyde they were exposed to over time, based on what we know about embalming fluid and just the general work environment of embalmers. And then we, of course, when they die, we have autopsy records that can tell us what kind of cancers they would get, and that's how we know if formaldehyde can cause cancer under these conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can work backwards to say what's the likelihood of getting cancer under lower conditions of the general population who might be exposed to formaldehyde, but not as much as embalmers or as often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one exposure type, for example, for formaldehyde would be, in some cases, gases coming off new carpeting that mm-hmm. might have mm-hmm. Formaldehyde in it. So that's one way to find mm-hmm. out, you know, information about a chemical carcinogen and what it can do under extreme conditions, and then we can extrapolate backwards to see what it would do under lesser conditions.
Mm-hmm. Or a chemical to move from likely to chemical carcinogen, would that chemical then have to go through the whole process again of being tested and everything, and then
yes,
move?
It would have to be evaluated. So basically, there's the first step. You did the first step, and you, based on the information that was available on that mm-hmm. on that mm-hmm. day, you put it in the reasonably anticipated group, but maybe 5 years down the road, or mm-hmm. 10 years down the road, there's more information now that has been gathered, and this additional information will now supplement the original information,
mm-hmm.
and then the whole evaluation process takes place all over again,
mm-hmm.
based on the new information, and then at that point, chemicals might move up the ladder of risk
mm-hmm.
to a more definitive level, change or stay the same.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mm-hmm. I will say that in the United States, we have the Environmental Protection Agency that does this risk assessment evaluation. The World Health Organization has its own. It's called the International Agency on International Agency for Research on Cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their own evaluation system that's international in scope, and they look pretty much at the same information, but they have scientists from all over the world who also go through the same kind of a process, and they have a similar kind of both methodology for review and system for stratifying or classifying carcinogens, except mm-hmm. that their titles might be slightly different, but mm-hmm. basically they all mean the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's either a human carcinogen, definitively, or it's something short of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you only have information that it causes cancer in animals only, then it could be called, for example, a probable
mm-hmm.
or a possible human carcinogen,
mm-hmm.
which is even less than probable. So, or the worst case scenario, it's a not worse. Well, when I say worse, I mean in the sense that there's not enough information at all. You would say it's not a carcinogen.
Mm-hmm.
So then a number of classifications, the number of classification schemes, and then there are a number of categories within each classification
mm-hmm.
that go from the least predictive to the most predictive for humans.
Mm-hmm.
So the most being non-human carcinogens. So the interesting thing is that after all these years of spending money on the war on cancer, which is, what, I think at least 50 years or so?
Right.
After all these years, the National Toxicology Program, that's a governmental program that was set up about 20 years ago as part of the National Institutes of Health with the express purpose of publishing an annual report, which is called the Report on Carcinogens. As it turns out, because of the amount of work, it's not annual. But they're now on the 13th annual report that was just published in 2014. And in that report, which is the government's report on carcinogens, which passed the regulatory review and classification based on the National Toxicology Program classification, in that report, they only have about 55 chemicals or chemical processes that they specifically identified as known to be human carcinogens.
Huh.
So after 50 years of the war on cancer, after all those years of review and evaluations, after all these agencies that have been formed, the mm-hmm. Environmental Protection mm-hmm. Agency, Food and Drug Administration, National Toxicology Program, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, all evaluating chemicals in the environment, they've only identified 56 chemicals that are known to be human carcinogens.
Hmm.
I will say that there's the second category, the reasonably anticipated to be human carcinogens,
mm-hmm.
is substantially larger. I would estimate about 200
mm-hmm.
or so, 150 to 200, but it just shows that the information available on those chemicals, this reasonably anticipated carcinogens, is still not sufficient to mm-hmm. put it in the most definitive category.
Mm-hmm.
So there have only been, 56 known human carcinogens.
I'm
what does
shocked.
That mean for the average individual?
Mm-hmm.
It means that when somebody tells you everything causes cancer,
mm-hmm.
that is not exactly true.
Mm-hmm.
Only 56 or so chemicals have actually been identified as causing cancer in humans.
Mm-hmm.
All
mm-hmm.
the rest of them have been shown to cause cancer in animals. From a safety point of view, we have to assume that if it causes cancer in animals, it could also cause cancer in humans.
Mm-hmm.
It's likely that it also causes cancer in humans. But it's the information mm-hmm. that's available is not that definitive to actually make that statement that it is causing cancer in humans.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the problem with the definition of carcinogens comes in, because
mm-hmm.
when you hear that a chemical causes cancer,
mm-hmm.
only 56 have actually been shown to cause cancer in humans.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest of them, at the most, cause cancer in animals.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know yet what their effect is in humans. We have assumptions, but we don't have proof. So that's where the dilemma is for the average individual.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do I do? First of all, the best I can tell you is you are what you eat.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you put in your mouth or whatever you're are exposed to could harm you. So if you put a chemical that causes cancer in your body, either directly or inadvertently, well, it potentially can cause cancer in people. Now, should you worry about it? Not necessarily. Why? Because if it causes cancer, it's all dependent on how much and for how long.
Mm-hmm.
So if you smoked one cigarette, for example, in a lifetime, your likelihood of getting cancer from that one cigarette is pretty nil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's very, very unlikely that you're going to get cancer from smoking one cigarette, even though that cigarette contains at least 50 chemicals that have been shown to cause cancer.
Mm-hmm.
in some method. So you've been exposed to carcinogens by smoking that cigarette. You inhaled it. It went into your body, got absorbed. But the amount of carcinogens to which you were exposed was very small. It was a one-time thing. And the likelihood, again, we cannot say it's a zero risk, but so you obviously have some risk, but it's very, very, very small, almost zero.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, if you smoke more cigarettes, then you're increasing your risk. If you smoked for 10 years, your risk is even higher. It's always good to stop smoking, so you reduce your lifetime risk, but even if you smoke 10 years, it's still a problem. So even if you stop smoking after 10 years, you still have that a problem, but you don't have as big a problem as if you smoked a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You only smoke 10 years. So the reason you stop smoking is to reduce your risk, and you're reducing your risk by reducing your exposure, your lifetime exposure to cigarette smoke, to just, let's say, 10 years, as opposed to continue smoking for an additional 20 years, and then your lifetime risk would be 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Lifetime exposure would be 30 years. So the whole idea about stopping smoking is reducing the amount of exposure, whether it's smoking or workplace or things in the environment, reducing the amount of your exposure. And sometimes that can be done just by eliminating, whether from the environment or stop smoking or don't get exposed to chemicals in the home, for example. And other times you can just reduce your exposure, for example, in the workplace by working, even though you're in a workplace that has carcinogens
mm-hmm.
in the atmosphere of the room, for example, if you wear a mask,
mm-hmm.
Especially fitted mask that allows oxygen but not exposure to the chemicals in the room. For example, people, let's say, are removing asbestos in older homes. They have to do it. They're exposed to asbestos, but they have masks, specially designed masks, so that they, even though they are within the confines of an area that has asbestos, nevertheless, they're not exposed to the chemicals specifically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's another way of reducing your risk is to, if you are working in a company, for example, with an employment capacity where you might have some exposure to carcinogens, this for workers' safety's sake, there's monitoring, there's air circulation, there's masks, and of course, various wearable apparatus to reduce your exposure to the carcinogens.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are human factors like adequate sleep, exercise, diet, etc., that will build the immune system that will have any effect on the chemical exposure?
Yes, so we are learning, every day we are learning more and more about how chemicals cause cancer
mm-hmm.
and what we should do about it.
Mm-hmm.
which is very interesting. So there are many people who believe that everybody's, first of all, we know that everybody's exposed to carcinogens somehow in the environment. For example, there's a lot of chemicals in the environment wherever you go, and whether from car exhausts or industrial settings, or and when you travel in other countries, they may have greater number of carcinogens in their environment than in the United States, for example. So, so we are all exposed to carcinogens, and yet not everybody gets cancer. So the question is, why don't some people get cancer and others do? And we don't know exactly that answer, but there are a number of what we call risk factors that are considered and that we can do something about. So, for example, some carcinogens are a risk factor, might be, there are some risk factors we cannot do anything about. So, for example, there are some carcinogens that seem to be related to hormonal imbalance. So let's say these carcinogens might be more effective in human, in the females than in males. Well, obviously, if you're a male, there's nothing much you can do, or vice versa, about that risk factor. But there are other things where you can do something about. So, for example, there's a lot of consensus where if you are exposed to carcinogens, the body has a way of healing itself. So we know that, for example, a simple example would be if you have a cut on your finger, eventually it clots and prevents either further bleeding or things coming entering the body through that cut from the environment. Well, that's the body's way of healing, where it reacts to the cut and closes the wound. So that's one example where the body can heal itself, and one of the systems in the body that helps in healing is the immune system. The immune system, which is composed of a number of factors, but one of them is the white blood cells. So we know, for example, when we get sick, the number of white blood cells increases tremendously, which basically shows that you have an infection. And what some people describe the white blood cells and red blood cells as little as soldiers who go in and combat the infection. And so there's a lot of research being done saying that if we are exposed to carcinogens and those carcinogens are circulating in our system, in our blood all over our, all of our body, before they interact with DNA and cause mutations, or even if they do cause some mutation in the body in some cells, and so before those mutations cause cancer cells to be formed, the immune system monitors all these invaders, if you will, and takes them out. If the amount of carcinogens is very low. Now, in some cases, your immune system is not, especially if, let's say, you're older. So people, one of the research, obvious research environments is, look, most people get cancer in their older age. They don't get it when they're younger. Not in all cases, but in many cases, the cancers are of cancers of what we call of old age. Prostate cancers of old age, you know, bladder cancer. The number of cancers that you tend to see more later in life than earlier in life. Why is that? Well, one of the thoughts is that the immune system in older age is not functioning as well as it did when you were younger. So, and basically, when you were younger, the immune system would be monitoring your body environment, and if they sees some exposure to a carcinogen, they would tackle it and remove it from your system before it causes havoc. But apparently, because it's not as efficient in older age, then the cancer cells overcome the immune system and cause cancer, or the carcinogens overcome the immune system and cause cancer. So a lot of the research is currently being done, especially in cancer treatment, is ways to stimulate the immune system to rejuvenate, if you will, and be able to tackle the incoming invaders of carcinogens, so that instead of killing off, trying to find drugs that are very toxic, like the cancer chemotherapy drugs, that are very toxic not only to the cancer cells but also to normal cells. We look for drugs that stimulate the immune system, which then tackles the cancer cells directly and does not affect the normal cell prevents the cancer cells from developing any further.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of research now has been very successful and, in fact, has led to drugs that, as we all know, President Carter was recently diagnosed with melanoma that had spread quite substantially throughout his body, and he was treated with drugs that stimulate the immune system and now has reduced his cancer load substantially to the point that some people are calling, saying that he's cured.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all because these new drugs stimulated the immune system to then tackle the cancer cells and kill it, if you will, and remove it from his system.
That's great.
So that's the latest, most recent and most interesting and exciting research that is being done in cancer chemotherapy, because the old chemotherapy drugs were and still used today, and they're still effective, but they're also very toxic to normal cells.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them are also carcinogens in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we treat or prevent cancer by stimulating the immune system and therefore tackling the cancer cells but leave the normal cells intact?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the latest research that has been very successful in many places, and that is stimulating the immune system.
Mm-hmm.
And people now are basically learning how to lead life by living with cancer, not looking at it as a death sentence, if you will, but looking at it as a chronic disease, similar to, for example, diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
People have diabetes, it's a chronic disease, and they live with it, and they treat it appropriately, and they continue their life.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing, researchers are looking for how to treat cancer. That is to say, people who have cancer should look at it as a chronic disease, not a death sentence, but as a chronic disease that can be managed and treated, and for which you can still maintain your lifestyle and continue, you know, living life.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And can you now tell us some of the chemical carcinogens and toxic chemicals that we have in our homes that we need to worry about?
Yeah, so if one is looking at the home environment and what's the likelihood that one is exposed to chemical carcinogens in the home and what should we do about it, the main chemicals of concern, the number one would be cigarette smoke. If you are smoking or if somebody else is smoking in the home, cigarette smoke contains approximately 50 carcinogens, and you inhale it, and even if you yourself are not smoking, but you have secondhand smoke, there's a lot of carcinogens in secondhand smoke. And one of the problems about cigarette smoke is, besides the fact that it has so many carcinogens in it, and also one is your exposure is on a daily basis, for the most part, either directly or indirectly. It's for a long period of time because people, it's habit-forming, so people smoke for a long time. And the thing is, and biologically, it's that the cigarette smoke, you inhale it, and when you get it into your lungs, in the lungs, the blood vessels are very close to the surface so that the chemical carcinogens in the smoke enter the bloodstream immediately, something to the order similar to, for example, getting an intravenous injection. When you get an intravenous injection of a pharmaceutical, it enters your bloodstream right away. When you inhale it, it enters the bloodstream directly in the lungs in a similar manner. So this is different than, for example, if you ingest a carcinogen, you know, through your food or dirty hands and you put them in your mouth, for example. Those chemicals have to go through your digestive tract. They might get metabolized. It takes time, you know, half an hour to an hour, depending on if you have food in your stomach. So there's a long process before it finally gets into your bloodstream, whereas inhalation, it gets into your bloodstream right away. And once it gets into the bloodstream, it goes all over the body. So cigarette smoke is the number one major concern in the home because, one, the number of chemicals, of carcinogens in cigarette smoke, two, the fact that it enters your bloodstream right away, three, because the exposure is usually for a large amount over a lengthy period of time, and four, of course, we know that cigarette smoke is very carcinogenic. Another thing in the home that of concern would be, in some homes, would be benzene. Benzene is of concern, especially in homes that have wood-burning stoves. Wood-burning stoves emit benzene, and benzene is one of those known human carcinogens. You also have some benzene in gasoline. So homes, for example, that have an attached garage, and if you're running the car in the garage, the exhaust has some benzene in it, and that can enter if it's an attached garage, especially if there's a window facing the garage from the basement, for example, then you can get the benzene exposure from the garage into the home. And then, of course, it's something that basically you don't smell. It's a gas. It goes all over the house, especially with the ventilation going. It starts going all over the house. So benzene would be another concern. Also, benzene is also present in cigarette smoke. So that would be another concern. And the third example would be grilling meat, for example, in the summer, charcoal grilled steaks. For example, you get formation of what we call nitrosamines. Mm-hmm. Nitrosamines are chemicals found in meat that, in high heat and grilling, then they also can cause cancer. And in this case, you'll be exposed to those chemicals by virtue of eating the meat or ingestion. Some people have grilling facilities within the home because they like to grill meat, and so they build it in their kitchen. And if they eat more grilled meat than the average person, they would tend to have greater exposure to potential nitrosamines. And then, of course, there are lots of chemicals that are in many of the products that you normally would find under the kitchen sink. So any of the house cleaning products might have chemicals that cause cancer. Should we worry about all of this? I would say sometimes yes, sometimes no. Because as I indicated at the opening of our discussion, it all deals with how much are you exposed and for how long. Mm-hmm. So if you're exposed to only one cigarette or smoke from only one cigarette, you'll have much less of a risk. And similarly, if you don't grill meat that often or exposed to chemicals from your household products that often, so if it's just incidental contact, incidental use, not something that you do on a regular everyday basis, and something that you don't have large amount of exposure, then your risk would be relatively low. So we are all exposed in one way or another to chemical carcinogens, whether in the environment or in the home. But what makes it different is that we are, generally speaking, exposed to low amounts mm-hmm. over a short period of times. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, that means it translates to low likelihood or low risk that those chemicals will cause cancer, mm-hmm. that it will cause cancer to us. And the other thing is that obviously we are concerned about cancer as a whole, but all chemicals that cause cancer, for example, they're not all the same. Mm-hmm. So we still don't know enough about why some chemicals cause cancer one way versus another way. Most generally speaking, we believe that chemicals affect the DNA, the hereditary material, and cause some mutations in the DNA that might lead to cancer cells when they divide. But not all chemicals that are known to be human carcinogens actually have been shown to cause mutations. So they might cause cancer by some other way, for example, mm-hmm. interfering with the repair of mutated cells, or might affect various enzyme or protein systems. So we don't know exactly, in most cases, we don't know exactly how the chemicals cause cancer, and we don't know, and even though we have lots of evidence that many chemicals that cause cancer also cause mutations, not all of them do, and yet they're still carcinogens. So there's a lot we know, but there's a lot more that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what I tell people is to be mindful of the big ones, cigarette smoke, drinking, alcohol, benzene exposure, nitrosamines in meat. And those are the kind of things that you can do something about.
Mm-hmm.
You can stop smoking, you can drink moderately, you can avoid benzene to the best of your ability, and don't grill meat too often.
Mm-hmm.
But many other chemicals for which we are exposed, for which we are exposed in low amounts and for short periods of time, and for which we may not even be able to do anything about because they're out there in the environment and the exposure is very low. And basically, the concern should be very minimal because our risk is very low from those kind of chemicals. And therefore, we should not really worry about them that much. You do the best you can, but you should live your life. And the ones that you can do about, you do something about. For example, you don't smoke, you drink moderately. And the ones that you can't do about, you do the best you can to avoid it and let the government reduce risk by reducing exposures.
And there are chemicals that do not cause cancer, right, but cause other problems.
Right. So basically chemicals are the ones that have not been shown to cause cancer. Of that number, some might be found to cause cancer at some point, but for now, what we know is that a lot of chemicals, especially if your exposure is to high amounts, could be toxic.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, just recently, I think in Flint, Michigan, there's a lot of exposure to lead in the drinking water from pipes that are corroded. And so lead is known, especially in children, to cause reduced IQ and developmental problems, depending on when the exposure occurs. So when the exposure occurs in life. So the major concern, it's a concern for everybody, but the major concern of lead is most definitely in children, especially the younger they are, the more concerned. But in this case, the Flint, Michigan case, the lead exposure is in the drinking water, and that was, if my understanding is correct, that was partly a state fault when they changed pipes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also, aside from that sort of a scenario, there's also exposure to lead in old housing, especially in low-income housing that has been painted, many years ago with lead-based paint.
Mm-hmm.
And paint, from 30 years ago or so that contained lead, especially in low-income housings, there tends to be a lot of chipping. So you get flaking, and you get flaking on the floor, and then you have the babies and the young children walking around and putting everything in their mouth, and before you know it, they're getting lead exposure from old paint and elevating the lead levels, which in turn can cause developmental and IQ problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that, unfortunately, is one of the byproducts of low-income housing, is that those housings tend to be painted, many years ago. They don't get repainted as often as other housing, and as a result, there's much more lead exposure in those kind of environments for which we have to do something about.
I remember when the government had programs for the lead-based paint in the houses, and many of the health departments around the country got funding and had these big programs where they went out and tried to remove the paint or paint over it or do something so that the children were saved from that exposure.
That is exactly true. But I will say that one of the things that I do is I assist attorneys in various cases.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen through my work as an expert witness I've been involved in cases where, even though we have all these governmental programs and they're all wonderful, I'm sure, and they do their best, but then nevertheless, there are cases where things fall through the cracks and you do get exposure to lead from old paint that apparently is still around, and you find, you know, chips on the floor and babies put that in their mouth. So so even though there's a lot of good work being done out there, nevertheless, we have to be mindful that that possibility still exists and still occurs today.
Our time is coming to a close soon, and I did want to hear about your first novel, A Death at Camp David, and also I'd like to hear about your books and any products or services and how the listeners can reach you if you have a website.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate that. My first novel, which was just published November 11th, 2015, it's called A Death at Camp David. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and iTunes. And it's a novel of a political intrigue and murder mystery. Basically, it's a quick two-liner would be the White House had a 4th of July party at Camp David. The next morning, they find the body of a woman under a tree. The rest of the book is what happened, who did it, and how does it affect the election of a woman running for president of the United States. There's a lot of mystery and intrigue and also a lot of humor, and it's held in the Washington, D.C. area, so there's a lot of information there that would be familiar to people living in this area. And it's, like as I mentioned, I have a book signing coming up at Barnes & Noble in Rockville on February 14. And this is the second book signing over there, the first one on December 13. Sold out within an hour, so I would suggest people arrive early in order to get an autographed book. Aside from that novel, I'm also working on my second novel at the moment, and I also have five scientific books. The one that the viewers might be most interested in would be a handbook of carcinogen testing, and that talks all about this everything that we discussed today in terms of the methodology for testing of chemical carcinogens, how the evaluation process takes place, the risk analysis. It's also available on Amazon. My website is www.toxnetwork. Tox is T like in Thomas, O, X like in X-ray, the word network, toxnetwork.com. It's my website, which basically tells you about my activities and my biography. And what I do is I assist as a toxicology and cancer expert, both for individuals and attorneys as an expert witness. I've assisted in over 250 cases, both defense and plaintiff, all in the area of toxicology and cancer, as well as assisting various pharmaceutical and chemical companies to evaluate the information and to come to some sort of conclusion and provide opinions on the toxic effects or carcinogenic effects of various chemicals and pharmaceuticals. I appreciate participating in today's workshop and show. It was really interesting for me. I leave you with the idea that everything does not cause cancer, as some people are worried about. There are many chemicals that are helpful and useful, and then there are some that could be detrimental, and we should try to minimize our exposure, both in terms of amount of exposure and the length or time of exposure. Continue to live life to the best as we can.
Thank you very much, Dr. Millman. This has been fascinating, and I appreciate it very, very much. So I thank you.
Thank you, too. I appreciate that being here, and I look forward to our next show.
Great. Good. I thank you for joining me today on the Holistic Health Show, and I hope some of the information will be useful to you. I invite you to my websites, holistichealthshow.com, where you will find all shows for the past 7 years under the blog. You will also find much of the research on natural ways to deal with cancer and other health conditions, and can sign up for my free monthly newsletter. On my website, beatlungcancer.net, you will find many of the 135 interviews from radio and television over the past 2 years about my book on treating lung cancer naturally and holistically when I was diagnosed 41 years ago next month and given 6 months to live by traditional medicine who offered chemo and surgery. This book was published in November 2012 and was a bestseller on Amazon. You will find endorsements of the book, a place to buy the book, and an earlier one from 2007 titled Healthy Holistic Aging, A Blueprint for Success. On my third website, you will find information on the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation, begun last year and currently in the phase of completing the website. This site is at www.holisticcancerfoundation.com. Information on how the foundation differs from others, board members, research on holistic natural ways to deal with cancer, including mental and spiritual interventions, interviews with cancer physicians and survivors, and more. If you would like to donate to the work I am supporting, there is a tab to donate, and I can offer you a tax exemption receipt if living in the United States. I also invite you to join me on Facebook at my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/Carl Helvey. On my Holistic Health Show page at www.facebook.com/pages/Holistic Health Show, and the Carl O'Helvey Holistic Cancer Foundation page at www.facebook.com/beatlungcancernaturalalternative. On LinkedIn, I invite you to join me under my name, Dr. Carl O'Helvey. On Twitter, I invite you to join me at www.twitter.com/HolistHealthShow, HolistHealthShow. I wish you a great week, and I look forward to having you here in 2 weeks. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host.